morning. Call to order the Senate Jobs and Economic Growth Committee. Good morning, members.
Good morning.
Happy Wednesday. We've got kind of two halves to this morning's committee. The first, we're going to talk to and about one of the agencies that falls beneath the jurisdiction of this committee, the Department of Labor and Industry. And then the second half, want to highlight one of the provisions and start talking about Senate File 1. So we'll take about 45 minutes for each of those. I'm going to do some housekeeping now. Okay. Ms. Berger is reminding me of a couple housekeeping items for members, but also for those of you in the audience. As the chair, I've started to meet individually with members of the committee, so encourage you, if you've gotten an email and trying to get something on the calendar, Ms. Berger will make that happen. Sat down with Senator Daley, sat down with Senator Metzen yesterday. Thank you again, sure. Ranking Member Metzen, for your time. And look forward to working with you guys. And then also, we've talked about, we briefly talked last week about a road trip that has now been locked in. So Friday, January 28th, we're going up to the range. I'm sorry that Senator Tomasoni is not with us this morning to brag about his backyard. And I'm actually not sure if we're going to have Senator Tomasoni with us on the 28th because of some surgery that he's undergoing. But he's kind of the comeback kid, so we might see him. So Friday the 28th, and please RSVP to Ms. Berger about your attendance, and we can talk logistics and how people are getting up there, rides and such. So I look forward to a day, a pretty full day on the range and hearing about that particular part of Minnesota and that particular economy. So let's go. Joining us this morning is Ken Peterson, who is the appointee. I don't know if I should call you Commissioner Designee, or I might just call you Ken, or Mr. Peterson. And we asked Mr. Peterson to come in and talk a little bit about himself. I know he's reaching out to members of this committee in some one-on-ones, which is good and important. And then also to give you a little sense for the department, who's involved, what they do, and how they will interact with this particular committee, and for members, just to be clear, so when the paperwork and the timing is right, this committee will oversee the confirmation of Mr. Peterson, and we also have the committee accounts and jurisdiction over this particular department, the Department of Labor and Industry, so we wanted to spend a little time with him this morning. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee, and again, this portion of time is yours to use as you see fit, and I will ask members to be a little patient and indicate to me if you have any particular questions, but I want to give these guys the time to tell their story. So, Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members, thank you. Thank you for having us today. Before I start, though, I'd like to acknowledge an individual in the audience today who's a good friend of mine. Former state senator, and as I'm a resident of St. Paul, proud resident of St. Paul, and this is the guy we call Mr. St. Paul, former state senator Joe O'Neill. It's right over
here. Hey, Joey.
I had the honor of working with Joe for several years and working with him at the city and on other civic things, and he is truly one of the great men of our state, and I'm very proud to know him and be his friend.
Mr. Peterson, I'm going to interject just to make sure it is clearly bipartisan. I consider Joe O'Neill a role model and a mentor, and anytime you want to come to the Senate Jobs Committee, Joe, we might even give you a seat at the table sometime. So thank you. And thank you, Mr. Peterson, for noting our esteemed visitor.
Mr. Chairman, thanks again for having us here. We appreciate it. With me at the table today is Cecilia Jackson, who's our the department's chief financial officer, and also John Rakowski, who's our government affairs person. Many of you may know John. He's represented the department up here for five or six years, and before that he represented the Department of Energy and Economic Development. If during the session or after the session, if you have any questions for the department or any issues that you have from constituents or issues of your own, please give John or me a call. John's number is 651-284-5103, and my number is 651-284-5010. So please contact us. We're here to help you. And we know you've got your jobs to do, and we'll do the best we can do to make, if you have any problems in our department or just questions, we want to know about them, so please get in touch with us. And we'll get back to you as quickly as possible. Also with me today is our newly appointed Assistant Commissioner, Jessica Lohman, who's right back here, just started yesterday, Jessica. And she'll be in charge of our construction standards, construction code and labor standards area. As some of you may know, this is my second stint as commissioner. I served in the job 20 years ago, and Governor Dayton was kind enough to appoint me again, and I'm very happy to do that. The department has changed some since then. There's new responsibilities been added by the legislature, and some of the laws we implement have changed. The technology has obviously improved. However, for my first week, I've noticed that one thing has stayed the same, and that is that the department employees are still very hardworking, and they're committed to serving the people of the state. And I also want to acknowledge the, I think my predecessor, Steve Sfigum, was a good commissioner, did a very good job, and left the department in good shape. I think the department has, as we'll go through in a few minutes, has downsized where it should have downsized and has stayed active where it should be active. I think there's been a good job over the years. In terms of my my background, I grew up in Minnesota. I'm from Osages, a proud Silver Streak from Osages High School, went to Hamline University, and then went to law school in Washington, D.C., and then moved back here and started legal practice in the Bemidji area, and then moved down to the Twin Cities in my early 30s and worked for the administration of Governor Perpich, and then was served as deputy mayor of St. Paul, and then was in private practice, and then worked as a deputy attorney general for 8 years, supervising the areas of, we call it government operations. So I supervised the attorneys representing those agencies in government, just representing the agencies in government. I was not on the consumer side, but basically just the operations of government. That's what I know. I know about government. I'd like to think I understand it, although sometimes it presents puzzles. But I think I understand it. I have a good idea, at least, how the dynamics work. I've enjoyed working it, and I also understand that different times require different responses. And that's one thing I've learned. And at the age of 63, I've learned that. It's taken me a long time, but I've learned that much. I am enjoying being back in the department. It's a good department. It's got a good work ethic. I'm proud of them for that. I'm going to be basing my presentation off the off this PowerPoint here, and I'll provide just an overview of what we do and how we do it.
And Mr. Peterson, before you get into your PowerPoint, if I could, we got a little bit into this when you and I sat down, but do you have any general kind of observations, having been the commissioner 20 years ago and now coming back and getting your feet under you over the last couple of weeks? What's your sense for how this particular state agency has changed or maybe even needs to change? I just wanted to get a little bit of the benefit of your perspective over multiple decades in this agency.
The workers' comp area is about 60% of what we do. We administer the workers' comp area. We don't decide most of the case. We have a mediation unit, but we administer it. And that has become a less contentious issue than it was 20 years ago. I think there have been some law changes in the 90s that have taken it out of the made the reforms that a lot of people thought were necessary, and seems to be working pretty well. At the time when I was commissioner last time, our costs were probably among the top 10. Now they're probably somewhere in the middle of the various states. That can vary from who studied what, but I think it's fair to say we're probably somewhere between 20th and 30th, somewhere in that area. So it's workers' comp is not what many would consider the competitive disadvantage that it was 20 years ago for our state. That's a huge change. It's a big change. In terms of the way we do things, in 1995, the legislature asked that the Workers' Comp Advisory Commission look at all bills before they came to the legislature. And that's composed of, it's chaired by the head of the state AFL-CIO and the head of the state Chamber of Commerce. And that's a good thing. So we tried to bring together the two areas. This is the Department of Labor and Industry. I mean, it's labor and industry, you know, business and working people. And it's a good place for the two of them to work out their issues. Not only in workers' comp, but in the other areas, we'll go through this. It's a very good place for them to work out the issues rather than bringing them to you folks and you having to decide with all the stuff you're dealing with, rather to bring a compromise to you. And if a compromise can't be reached, don't bring it. And that's what's happened in workers' comp, and I'm glad of it. So we've taken that acrimony out of the system. And so I think the system works better. It's more predictable for insurers, more predictable for the lawyers, and hopefully more predictable for the injured worker and others that are concerned about. So that's a huge change, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Peterson. I concur. It sounds like it's an easier job for you now.
Yeah, I take naps in the afternoon now.
You might want to wait till you're confirmed.
Before I do that? That probably was a poor thing to say, Mr. Chairman.
We're glad you're comfortable here, Mr. Peterson. Go ahead.
I think that answers your question. The construction codes, I'll get into a little more there. That's been a challenging area, but when we get to that, I'll talk more about it. But one thing I want to reiterate on the workers' comp area, that workers' comp was the first workers' comp law was passed in Wisconsin in 1911, and it was a compromise between business and labor. The idea behind it, for those of you who aren't familiar with this, the idea behind it is that people who are injured on the job agree not to bring suit, like in district court, in exchange for they're getting a guaranteed benefit. They're hurt, and they're hurt on the job, legitimately hurt on the job, they know they'll get a benefit. They'll get indemnity payments, and they'll get their medical costs paid for. So the working people, the injured worker gives that up. On the other hand, the employer gives up, it doesn't have to be exposed to the idea of getting sued, where the judgments can go up, could be high or low, but the employer has to promise to provide workers' comp insurance to those workers. So there's a trade-off that's happened. And it seemed to work throughout the country. Every state has done it. It's interesting to look at the history of workers' comp. I think that it was from 1911 until the early 1920s. Every state passed it. And it's been pretty successful, I think, nationwide. People can talk about, you know, fix this part of the plan or fix this part of the system or that part of the system. But overall, it's a good way of doing it. I just want to make that pitch very clear, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
In terms of, I actually do want to encourage you to ask questions as we go through this. I know some of you have been on this committee before, but others haven't. And so please feel free to ask questions, and we'll do the best we can to answer them. I'm going to be using some numbers, but those numbers, they're just some projections. The governor has not presented his budget yet, and you haven't approved a budget. But we'll talk about some numbers that just to make things make more sense. When I was appointed, the governor asked me to do two things. He said, I want you to make sure the workers' comp system is efficient, get rid of, make sure that the individuals get their benefits as quickly as possible. At the same time, the other thing I'm really concerned about, even more concerned about, is jobs. Do not do anything that's going to interfere with job growth in our state. And so that's what I'm trying to tell you folks when I meet with you individually, is that we'll be, at least under my stewardship of the department, we'll be trying to avoid any kind of regulatory overreach. We know that a lot of stuff we do is very necessary and has to be done. And we'll do a good job of that. At the same time, we'll try to avoid overreaching regulations and try to interfere with legitimate job growth. The other part of it, within that framework, we're going to follow the law. I've just met with Senator Creef, and he was talking about a county employee had come up with some new regulations. We're not going to come up with new regulations without telling you and talking to you and talking to the various people impacted by it. We'll be dealing with both labor and industry and others, the various parties, before we pop out with something. But we will follow the law, and we're going to treat everybody we deal with fairly and decently. I don't want anybody to leave our department thinking that we've been arrogant or that they haven't understood what happened to them. And as a manager, I want the people work under me to work hard, to be efficient, but I also want them to go home at night feeling very good about their jobs, that they could not be doing, be working at a more important place than they're working now, and they should feel very fulfilled in what they're doing. So that's sort of my mantra about management, how I want to do things. Our mission, which you can see, is to ensure that Minnesota's work and living environments are equitable, healthy, and safe, and that we want to be trusted and an impartial regulator for employees, employers, and property owners. I'm not going to this one. I'll go to the next thing. It'll be more telling. The Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry. Minnesota laws related to employment, apprenticeship, workplace safety, workers' comp, and construction of buildings. We provide training, outreach, and other resources to our customers, promulgate construction codes, conduct plan reviews, inspections, audits, review workers' compensation claims, and oversee the provision of benefits, provide informal dispute resolution services. We do mediation. We have a small voc rehab services for injured workers. We issue penalties, issue professional license and certifications. We issue like 110,000 licenses every biennium. So we're in the license business, electricians and others, and register apprenticeship programs. This is just a chart, flow chart, that the commissioner, deputy commissioner. You see we have basically three areas, safety and workers' compensation. That's OSHA and workers' comp. In the middle, sort of the support functions, what we called in graduate school overhead functions of government, accounting, human resources, legal, that sort of thing. Then construction codes and labor standards. That includes, we have plumbing board, electricians board, other things, and apprenticeship and labor standards. Pretty clear stuff. 431 employees, and our budget's $259 million, but that's deceptive, which I'll go into, in terms of the work we do. This says, yes, revenues by fund. You can see that workers' comp is the red, the cardinal color, and that accounts for, these are assessments that go to the department on employers. I think it's like a 7% assessment now, or maybe it's 8, somewhere in that, that goes to the department. It's $189 million a year. I'll discuss where that goes in just a minute. You can see the smaller areas, the construction code area, 17%. Those are for licensing fees, permitting fees, that sort of thing. That's 17%, $43 million. The federal government provides $10 million. That's basically matching funds for the OSHA program. We pay for OSHA 50% out of the workers' comp fee, workers' comp assessment, 50% out of the federal funds. Special revenue funds, less than 5%. And then the general fund, and then the others is basically, I think, penalties. But the general fund basically only accounts for one division of the department, and that's our labor standards apprenticeship, and that's $1.7 million.
And so, Mr. Peterson, excuse me for a second, just again to highlight that for members, as we work through a two-year budget, it's unlikely that the Department of Labor and Industry's budget is going to be a big player in those discussions.
Very small.
Mr. Chair, for better or worse, we can't balance. We're not going to be able to do away with that $6.2 billion deficit in our backs.
Go ahead, Mr.
As much as we might want to. Well, here, just I want to explain where that money goes to, though. This is sort of our projected 2012 total expenditures, $132 million. The salary, as you go across the top, salary accounts for 27% of that total figure, and we have 431 full-time equivalents. And then the operations, that's basically rent and buying paper and pencils and that sort of thing. It's 3%. So our total for the just operating department and for is 30%. Then the external is 70% where the money goes. Now, under that safety and workers' compensation division, the Vinland grant, Vinland is a small rehabilitation center in Loretto, Minnesota, $200,000 for benefit claims for injured workers. It's $70 million. Now, that comes out of the what's called, well, I'll come more into that in a little more detail later, but some of that is for the supplemental claims, other parts for the second injury fund, both of which have been repealed, but there are still workers who are qualified to receive it, and they'll be receiving those benefits until they die. So that'll end somewhere around 2050, but that number keeps going down every year. Then we also fund the workers' comp aspects. We fund the workers' comp court of appeals, which hears a workers' comp case. What happens in a workers' comp case goes from the administrative law judge to the court of appeals and then to the state Supreme Court. So it's a special court of appeals for workers' comp. So that's 1.7. The Office of Administrative Hearings, they have, I don't know, about 20 judges or so. So they get $7.2 million. Fraud investigations for workers' comp in the Commerce Department gets $751,000, and Minnesota Management Budget, the finance agency, gets $100,000. OSHA consultation, where we have safety grants, about $1 million. And loggers rebates, we have a great program working with loggers. Loggers rates, this I'm proud to take some credit for this myself. Back in the late 80s, early 90s, loggers' work comp rates are going to the ceiling. So we set up the special program for loggers, and so we have a rebate and provides for training. It's been very successful, $720,000. Then you can see the construction codes. We have a contractor recovery fund, $3.3 million. And also we pay, most of our electrical inspections in the state are done by contract employees. They're not state employees. So we hire them, and so we're able to, as business goes up, we can give them more business. Business goes down, we don't give them so much. And that's $7.1 million. In labor standards, we have $10,000 that goes to people that aren't getting their wage payments. So the total, our total energy external expenditure is $92 million.
And Mr. Peterson, on this chart, I have Senator Kielash with a question. Senator Kielash.
Yes, Mr. Peterson, I was looking at the Workers' Comp Court of Appeals, and one of the things we're hearing is the courts are underfunded. I was just wondering if you've got a backlog of cases or if they're able to keep up with the caseload that they have.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I've not heard that. Most of the courts are funded out of the general fund.
Mm-hmm.
This is funded out of the workers' comp assessment, so they've been adequate funding for them.
Okay, thank you.
I've not heard, and I've been on the job for 2 weeks,
yeah,
so
I understand.
But I haven't heard that they have a problem. If they do, we're going to take care of it.
Okay,
if there's backlogs, we're going to take care of it. I don't think we need to hire more people, but we can take care of it.
Okay,
seems to me working together with our department and the OEH, we can take care of it.
Thank you.
Senator Kreif.
Thank you, Senator Michelle, Chairman. Mr. Peterson, I have a question on this Vinland grant. What is that? What's that for?
Mr. Peterson, or do you want your able...
You answer? Yes, sir. I'll have Ms. Jackson answer that.
Ms. Jackson.
Hi. Mr. Chairman and Senator Kielash, or Senator Cray, the Vinland grant is $200,000 a year. And what the Vinland Association does, it's located, as our commissioner indicated, in Loretto, Minnesota. They provide rehab services for injured workers and also for disabled workers. Injured workers through the vocational rehabilitation section are sent to Vinland, and they provide services and coordinate services for injured workers. And typically, we out of the $200,000, we have spent up to the $200,000 last year. We spent $198,000 in providing those services for the injured workers.
And Ms. Jackson, as a follow up to Senator DeKreif, that line item, that amount, $200,000. How has that fluctuated over time? Has it been a pretty consistent number, or has that moved up and down?
That has been a consistent number at least since 2007. So over the last four years or so, it's been a consistent $200,000 per year.
Senator DeKreif, did you have any follow-up? Or is that good?
No, that's fine.
Senator Howe?
Mr. Chairman, could you tell me, of the $200,000, what percentage of that is actually Vinland's... What portion of that is their budget? Is that their total budget?
Senator, do you mean in terms of their operating budget and those types of things?
Correct. What part of $200,000, what percentage of that is their operating?
Ms. Jackson, I don't know if you know that, but...
No, I'm not certain. I would have to check and get that back to you.
And Ms. Jackson, if you could supply that to Senator Howe, that would be helpful and appreciated. Mr.
Sure.
Peterson, you want to continue? Or Senator Metzen?
On that issue,
Senator Metzen.
I would guess that, Mr. Chairman, be a very, very small part of the Midland budget, very small part. I've been out there, and they really do good things, and seems like some of the worst cases they handle, and I don't think this is a big number for what they accomplish and what they do out there. So I've been there a couple times, and it's amazing what how they take care of these people.
Senator Howe, as a follow-up?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's kind of my point. I'd like to know how they fund their operation. I mean, is it through insurance claims, or, I mean, that's exactly what I'd be driving for. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson.
The next thing is actually a two-year projected. So the numbers are a little different than the numbers you just looked at. It was just easier for us to do it this way, but we're looking at fiscal year 2012-2013 for our projected budget. It's not, once again, it's not the budget that's going to be approved. But here you can see that the effect of the supplementary benefits will be $50 million a year or $100 million for the next 2 years. Supplementary benefits were, I don't think we need, for those of you who are new, it basically had to do with trying to allow a permanently injured worker to get 65% of the average weekly wage in the state. But that was repealed in 1995. Second injury benefits were for employers who had employees with second injuries. That was repealed in 1992, but we still have obligations, so that money continues to go out to them. Then we have $19 million in the biennium goes to employees of uninsured and bankrupt self-insured employers. You can understand it. Employer's not doesn't buy workers' comp. Employee gets hurt, and they got to go somewhere. So they go to this fund, and they're compensated. And that's paid for by an assessment across all the insurers. And then there's a cost of administering the system and the cost of the other activities. You can see that below. And here's just a chart of the department's expenditures. You can see that it's similar to what we already had, except it's not some of the external things. Workers' comp benefits are 54% of the total department budget. That's the stuff in red. Then the construction codes, $50 million for the biennium, $25 million apiece, 19%. And then general support, 7%. Workers' comp, OSHA administration, 18%. And labor standards, less than 2%. And I realize we'll be going into more detail on this later on, Mr. Chairman, but I thought I just wanted to expose you to a little bit of it.
Thank you.
And we'll quickly go through the rest of the department. In the workers' comp section, helps employees injured on the job receive proper medical treatment, benefit payments in a timely manner, mediate disputes. Those are smaller disputes that we can somehow get people to come to an agreement so they don't have to go to trials. Less expensive, quicker. We'd like to think it works well. I'll be looking at that to make sure it's not causing an unnecessary obstacle, though. We will be looking at that over the next few months. And we also issue penalties for late benefit payments. What happens if an employee doesn't get paid, then they call us. They don't get their benefit on time. They call us. We call on the insurance company. And the insurance company simply refuses to pay or doesn't pay. We issue penalties against them. And that gets our attention. And then we review records to make sure that state laws are followed. We're divided into four different sections. I don't think I need to go into detail what those different sections do, but we are four different sections. And you can see one is vocational rehab. We have a small vocational rehab unit there. OSHA compliance. OSHA, as I said earlier, is paid for. We have what's called a partnership agreement with the federal government. I think there are about 20 other states, maybe 25. I'm not sure what their number is. But that do the same thing we do. 50% is paid for out of state funds, 50% out of federal funds. And we ensure we enforce the Minnesota Occupational and Safety and Health Act. The 50% of the state funds are paid for out of the workers' comp assessment. So it's related to if we have fewer, the idea behind OSHA is trying to bring down injuries on the job. And so it makes sense to pay for it out of the workers' comp system as opposed to the general fund. Because it does benefit, hopefully benefits the injured worker, the potential injured worker, prevents future injuries, that sort of thing. Our OSHA works pretty well. We've had a history of doing kind of unique things that We had the right-to-know laws, first in the country, of the WARE Act, which requires employers to provide their own kind of safety plan, health and safety plan in the workplace, so they're thinking about workers' comp. We also, Minnesota employers are generally pretty good. And so over time, it's evolved that our penalties are probably a little bit less than the, on average, seem to be a little less than the federal government's. And I hope that's in recognition of just our employers. They're doing a good job. But they do seem to be less. And we adopt new and existing OSHA regulations and respond to employee complaints of workplace hazards and discrimination due to health and safety issues.
Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
I'm looking at this. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, at this.
I ought to go back there.
Picture on the left on the OSHA thing. Looks like they should have received a citation. Look at these two guys down there. I assume they're guys. I don't know. Without any walls or any protection around them, it looks like they. But just an observation, I think.
Senator Metzen, you're looking at the one where it looks like the crane's about to fall over.
Oh, yeah. The ladder's going to hit that guy, and the big crane on the top's going to crush the guy, the first guy. And the guy down below, it's going to cave in on him. But anyway,
Mr. Pearson,
go back out to that site and take a look at it.
I've lost complete control of this thing here. So
boy.
So I don't know where we're at. I got so upset with Senator Metzen's comments that I just lost it completely. I'm trying to figure this thing out.
Join the club, Mr. Peterson.
Yeah, how do you get back there?
Yeah, I think we've now ended your presentation.
These two guys got killed on the job.
How we're doing this.
They're pointing out the need.
Help. What do you do here?
Trigger hand.
Not quite sure where we're.
We all have the members of hard copies. I think.
Let's just go ahead with that. I'm sorry. I apologize. But OSHA workplace safety consultation is the great thing. Here, what you can do is an employer. We provide OSHA workplace consultation comes to the workplace and provides just advice on how to improve your workplace to make sure it's safe. Without telling the compliance section about it, unless there's something, a real imminent hazard. So if you're a small business or a large business, and you say, how can we improve this workplace without getting in trouble with OSHA? So they call us up, we'll send out an inspector or a consultant to you, and they'll give you advice on how to improve it, what steps you can take, and we don't tell compliance about it, and so hopefully they'll have a safer and better workplace. And we've had a number of, if you can see on this sheet, we have a number of partnerships with, they've been very successful in the last few, the recent ones, the Children's Hospital, the DEC, Duluth Entertainment and Convention Complex, TCF Bank Stadium, Target Field, St. Louis Park Shops at the West End, and the University of Minnesota AmPlatz Children's Hospital. Those are construction projects where we've worked together and resulted in just an astonishing low injury rates. And we've also had a number of recent general industry partnerships throughout the state. You can see those. One thing that OSHA, or that workplace consultation says, that they believe they saved over $3 million last year in penalties by going to workplace and helping them improve it. And even more important, they probably saved a lot of people from getting injured. And that's really what the key is. And it's been successful. So we like that. And even better, 90% of it's paid for by the federal government. And we pay for 10% of it. Next sheet is, let's go to construction codes and licensing, which is, in 2005, Governor Pawlenty, I think wisely so, wanted to set up a one-stop shop for the construction, for construction licensing. So he consolidated it all in the Department of Labor and Industry. And so, these boards regulate everything that's behind the walls and under the street. That in terms of construction codes, electricians, electrical stuff, plumbing, high-pressure piping, and the plans done by individual cities, that we do that stuff in the construction codes and licensing area. It's worked pretty well. We're still going through some of the growing pains of trying to work out some of the financing. Last year, we brought a comprehensive bill through the past of the legislature, trying to work out some of the fees, make them more even. And so that really each fee, in terms of licenses and permits, only charge what the cost for doing them were. So we're trying, and we'll come back with a few smaller ones this year to do the same thing that we overlooked last time. But we're trying to get as close to possible as cost. The cost of the service that we provide is paid for. So we don't want the electricians or the electrical people subsidizing the plumbing area or vice versa. We want each area to cover its own cost.
Bless you.
And you can see what the budget there is. The next area is labor standards, which is we have a division called Labor Standards and Apprenticeship. This covers labor and employment laws, minimum wage, overtime, child labor laws, prevailing wage, parental leave laws, and employee rights regarding termination of employment and wages due. This area, they get a lot of phone calls, 185 phone calls a day. So in terms of, they don't spend as much time on the road as they might want to because they're trying, people are calling up and with legitimate questions, we're trying to help and answering them. And so we're, in that sense, we're cutting out a lot of the unnecessary work by calling people and saying there's not been a legal violation, or if there has been a legal violation, we'll follow up on it. The whole unit gets somewhere around 25,000 phone calls per year. We only investigated about 500 cases here, though. So we're, Minnesota employers, like I said, are pretty good. You know, there may be a case where people only know about us, they don't come in. But I think for the most part, our employers are treating our employees pretty well, and we're, I think we should be proud of that. We also provide community services, outreach and education, and provide documents in different languages for employees of different areas, from Spanish, Hmong, Arabic, Laotian, you can read that, Russian and other areas, to ensure that employees who do speak other languages understand their rights as well as English-speaking employees. Apprenticeship is the final area that... Apprenticeship is one of the great way of learning, and I don't think we do enough in our society to, in America, not just Minnesota, but throughout the United States, to emphasize the importance of it. Germany does a great job in apprenticeship programs, and they've done and one of the consequences, Germany has a very successful manufacturing, high-end manufacturing. In our country, we haven't been quite so successful, and I think part of the reason is we haven't done as well an apprenticeship as we should have. But anyway, we do have a small unit that regulates registered apprenticeship programs in the state. We monitor something like 300 programs, and there are about 7,200 employees involved in them. Last year, we did adopt a lot of apprenticeship programs that are basically based on length of service. You work 4 years and you become a journeyman. We've also adopted a way that you can establish by passing a competence test as well as by length of service. And that seems to be one way of trying to attract more people to apprenticeships to understand this way of learning. It's a very effective form of learning, combining on-the-job training as well as some textbook classroom training. So anything we can do over the next few years to increase our appreciation of apprenticeship, I want to do that. That, Mr. Chairman, completes the sort of substantive area we've talked about. Certainly open to any questions you may have or the other members may have.
And we've got a few minutes for committee questions. Let me start off with a couple for you, Mr. Peterson. You alluded to this a little bit in your testimony, but are you preparing some department legislation? Do you assume you will be coming to us with some specific language once you and the governor's office get on the same page?
Mr. Chairman, members, we
Mr. Peterson.
I do anticipate an agreement between business and labor on some workers' comp issues. Not major, but some real agreement that we will be bringing to the committee. There may be, we will have a bill on some of the fees in the construction code area that we were overlooked last year that we want to correct. There may be a few other minor areas, but I think those are the only significant ones, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. And then also just to make it clear to members, Mr. Peterson, if
If any of us have a constituent call or a question or an inquiry that involves what your department does, what's the best point of contact for those questions? Should we use Mr. Rajkowski, for example? Or
what use Mr. Rajkowski, use me. We'll get back to you right away. I can't give you any high. John's really good. John's been doing this stuff for a while. He knows government. He knows the department. He'll get back to you. I'd like to think I'm pretty good at that, too. So give us a call, either John or myself.
Appreciate that. Let's start with Senator Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Peterson, thank you for being here today and sharing this information with us. I do believe that businesses in Minnesota are very interested in providing a safe environment for their employees to work, and I agree with you that we are generally in very good shape as far as the work environment that we do provide. One of the challenges that businesses have is that the advice versus penalize difference with OSHA. And how do we be more of a partner with businesses trying to improve the work environment? I do see we're talking about the OSHA compliance and also the worker safety consultation. And could you just explain and share with us a little bit of information about how do you keep the two separate? Is there a system to keep the information separate from the two so that a business truly will have an environment and have an opportunity to improve that work environment for their employees? And then also there's that penalty and advice situation even within OSHA. How can we work better to work with businesses to make sure that they're doing what they need to, but also make sure that it isn't just a penalty to penalize environment?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lilly, good questions. Thanks.
The
workplace consultation records are kept complete and computer systems are kept completely separate from the compliance section. They can't penetrate. Only times when there's a consultation visit to, say, your newspapers, if there's an imminent hazard to somebody, if you've got, I don't know, a wall is going to cave in, then they're going to tell them. And they're going to tell you, too. Mm-hmm. But if there's something that's endangering people, they're going to do something about that. And I don't think anybody disagrees with that. So we do try to keep it as separate as possible. And I've emphasized that just in my early meetings with individuals, and I'll continue to emphasize. And I think the people there are pretty good. They're very conscious of their responsibilities in both areas. And in some ways, the people who end up in consultation are the type of people who are not – I don't want to use this. It sounds too extreme, but they don't have that kind of cop mentality. They've got more of a cooperative mentality, and they want to work with you. They understand that, and they know what their job is. So I have not heard any reports of anybody doing that. I understand people be suspicious, though. I mean, it's legitimate. Mm-hmm. But I don't think people have to worry about it. They shouldn't. We'll do everything we can do, and if there is someone that does it, we'll discipline them. We'll take care of them. I assure you that. There's no question. We will take care of them because that's a violation of the Citizens Trust and the State's Trust.
Just as a follow-up, I do want to commend the organization because we have had opportunity to have both, and the consultation is effective, and I do believe that as a department we need to find a way to share that message, and one of the things that I think would help is if there is an opportunity to do it on a more regular basis, whether that's every certain number of years or how that might be. But providing an access point that businesses can predict when this service might become available, and by that can do a better job of protecting their employees.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I agree. We'll try to do it. I'm not quite sure how to do it, but we'll try. I think that's a great idea. We'll try to make every effort to do it.
I have Senator Nelson, and then I want to wrap up this portion of the hearing and. But take your time, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, I just have a brief question, and that has to do with e-licensing. I'm just wondering if you can tell me where you are in that process and what you anticipate that to look like or what maybe you might have learned from other departments that have already rolled through that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, this e-licensing is a – we'd like to have it completed by the 1st of October. It's a program that was set up last year, and the idea is to have it completed by the 1st of October. It's difficult. I haven't I'm asked for a complete briefing after our meeting that we had last week, and I haven't had that yet, but we're finding it much more difficult to do the e-licensing, I think, than originally envisioned. So we're gonna try to have it done. We're going to try and meet with it and try and make it work. Same time, we shouldn't kid ourselves that this doing various types of e-licensing is just you wave a magic wand and it happens. It's difficult. So we're going to do everything we can do to meet the deadlines and make it work. But if it doesn't work, we're going to tell you that we can't do it. I hope that's a complete answer. I want to be as honest as possible. I have not had the briefing I would like to have on this whole thing, but we are having some. It's more difficult than we thought.
Just a quick follow-up. Is it something that maybe we'll learn more about it after you get that briefing. But I can't tell from your comments if you're looking forward to this as being something that's going to be really helpful or if you're thinking that it's maybe not going to be that helpful. That's what I'm trying to get at.
From my early conversations, Mr. Chairman, Senator, from my early conversations with our people, I'm skeptical. At the same time, we want it to work. That's about as complete as I can actually say it. I'm skeptical,
okay.
But I hope we can make it work.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Senator Howe has promised me that this will be short, and Senator Howe, if you need more follow-up,
sure.
I'm going to encourage you to kind of walk outside with these folks afterwards. I'm sure they will follow up with you. But Senator Howe, briefly.
Mr. Chairman, just real briefly, can you just elaborate just briefly on the fraud investigations and what the return on investment is there? Has that went up because of the state of the economy? And
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Howell, that's done by the Department of Commerce. We've kept them separate. The fraud investigations are kept separate from what we're working. Or you mean fraud investigations of insurance companies or individuals receiving?
Well, you have a
Senator Howell.
That
Mr. Chair, you have about $750,000.
That goes to the Department of Commerce. That's the Department of Commerce doing it. We have no control over it. I haven't heard. We fund it, but I haven't heard how they're doing.
Okay.
We'll try to. That's a good question, though. We'll get back to you.
Thank you.
We'll find out if they have any records or what records they have and get back to you. That's a good question. I wish I knew it.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson, and thanks to your team for giving us a quick overview. And I also appreciate how you are diligently going about meeting with individual members to answer their questions and, more importantly, to introduce yourself. And we look forward to you coming in front of this committee on probably for multiple matters. So thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Fair.
Yeah. So, members, we have about a 45-second halftime here as Mr. Peterson and his folks leave. So let me help set the table for the second half here. And maybe while I'm doing this, if I could ask Ms. Rocco, could you come on up to the table with your group as we try to use our time efficiently here. Members, I appreciate your indulgence. We've only been able to have one committee meeting per week given holidays and floor sessions. So next week is actually the first week that we'll have two sessions in 1 week, and actually we'll add a third with our
we can get that machine turned off.
Yeah. We'll try not to blind you down there.
Can we power it off?
So next week we'll go to a third committee meeting. But what I wanted to continue was what I'd kind of define as our macro level discussion about jobs and economic growth, focused particularly on the private sector. We don't have a bill in front of us today to mark up, but starting next week we will have Senate File 1. One of the provisions in Senate File 1 is particular to property taxes that businesses pay, and that particular provision talks about a rollback of the property tax level and then a freeze. And so I wanted to spend our remaining time in committee this morning particularly on that provision, and then again we can talk about the bill in its entirety starting next week. I look forward to doing that with all of you. And so maybe let me just say a little bit more at the front end here and then introduce our visitors. But the general notion behind Senate File 1 is to try to answer the question of how do we lower the cost of doing business in Minnesota? What things can we do here in St. Paul to increase the confidence, to increase the level of certainty that our job creators have as we kind of struggle through a tough economy and a recession? What can we do to make this place look more attractive so that when that economic recovery comes, that some of the people in this room can take off and can create jobs in Minnesota and take the rest of the state with them? So I wanted to spend a little more time real specifically on that business property tax issue, and Ms. Rockow has been a good source of information and reference for me in the past, and I know she has some members who can help put some more light on this topic. So I'll also note for the members in your handout, you have a bill summary. You've got a revenue fiscal impact piece on the property tax provision, and I'll just note that in the next biennium budget that we're putting together, it's about $78 million in tax relief. And so with that, Ms. Rockow, I hope you're prepared, and I assume you will be prepared to talk, I guess, specifically about business property taxes, but I think the committee would be eager to hear a more general overview. How are things going with your members, in your industry? How do you think the economy is doing? Are we seeing some signs of recovery? So let me just kind of tee up the conversation in that way, and I will turn it over to you for now, Ms. Rockow, and to introduce your members and use the time as you see fit. I do want to allow for some committee questions and discussion. So thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Senator Michelle. Good morning, members of the committee. I'm going to do a quick overview of where we are at with property taxes, and Mr. Masha and Mr. Wise will be able to get into more specifics as it relates to their business and the commercial real estate industry in general. Good morning. My name is Kay Rocco, and I am the Director of Public Policy for NAIOP, the Commercial Real Estate Development Association, representing the interests of owners, developers, and managers of commercial real estate, along with the thousands and thousands of tenants in the buildings that we own and manage. And quite simply, we need job growth to help fill the vacant space in those buildings. That in turn will generate economic activity and ultimately get our commercial real estate values back to points in the past. So I am here this morning to offer support for the property tax provision of Senate File 1, because all businesses, Minnesota's job creators, large and small, regardless of income or profitability, or whether they lease or own their buildings, pay that property tax. Now, very deliberate increases in property taxes in the mid-80s was the single issue that galvanized NAIOP's public policy efforts. Because through actions of government at all levels, in 1994, the effective property tax rate, which is the percentage property taxes paid as a percentage of value, reached a high of 5.94%. So imagine if your home property tax bill was 6% of your value. That's what businesses were facing in the middle 90s. And then eventually, over the course of the years, through actions of policymakers of all persuasions, they began to realize that this high property tax rate was on our job creators was putting Minnesota at a real competitive disadvantage. So ultimately, changes were made to the property tax system, culminating in the 2001 reform, which reduced the effective tax rate on businesses on a statewide average to around 3%. And just so that the other thing about the 2001 reform is that it reduced the effective rate of all property taxpayers. So homeowners, for an example, have an effective rate of just a little over 1%. And even though commercial properties in Minnesota or business property taxpayers have experienced significant competitive improvement since 1995, according to the Minnesota Taxpayers Association, property taxes on a commercial building in Minneapolis are still 12 to 44% higher than the national average. And in Glencoe, Minnesota, a commercial building will pay 19 to 54% higher in property taxes than the national average. And I want to, before I turn it over to Mr. Mosh, I want to share some comments that I heard Representative Lencheski say in the House Tax Committee meeting last week after a presentation on Minnesota's property tax system by the House fiscal staff.
Oh, Ms. Rocco, I don't know. We're going to bring in the House already?
Well, I will be quoting, maybe I'll be quoting you guys when we're over there discussing this bill.
If you'll quote Metzen a few times when you're over there.
More than happy to.
Those will be good quotes.
Ms. Rocco.
This is what Representative Lencheski said in part. In the end, the effective rate is what you pay. And I am noticing that the highest effective rate in our property tax system is paid by our business community overwhelmingly. Just look at the numbers. In my take, as we hear a lot about helping businesses with jobs, is that the biggest tax businesses are paying is the property tax. It is also the most unfair tax they pay. So we should spend time thinking about that as we go forward in trying to assist Minnesota businesses create jobs. So that's why we're supportive of the property tax provision in Senate File 1, because reducing fixed costs, costs they cannot control, such as the state general property tax, on job creators is certainly a step in the right direction, and we thank you, Senator Michelle. Mr. Mosh?
Don't thank me yet.
Good start.
Thank you, Kay. Senator Michelle, members of the committee, thank you for your time this morning. My name is Patrick Mosh. I am here on behalf of NAIOP. I am currently first vice president of NAIOP. I am the immediate past chair of NAIOP's Public Policy Committee. I will be president of the organization in 2012. In my real job, I run the Minnesota operations for Duke Realty Corporation in St. Louis Park. Our company is a real estate investment trust. We're headquartered in Indianapolis. We own approximately 134 million square feet of office, industrial, and retail space, and medical office space around the country. We're in 18 different markets. Locally, we own 5.3 million square feet. We employ 34 people. And our recent projects include Norman Point 2, the office building at 494 and Highway 100 in Bloomington, as well as the West End redevelopment project and shops at West End, which Mr. Peterson previously mentioned in his testimony. Our business basically is we buy, own land, we then build a building, we take that building, lease it up to tenants who are really the true job creators, and then we own and manage that building for the long term within our own portfolio. Our business really isn't rocket science. It's a matter of cost to build the building. The rents that we can generate produces our investment return and expected yield. To the extent our costs are higher, that means that our tenants have to pay higher rent. So property taxes are a component of our initial development cost on the front end. And the higher the property tax, the higher the rent that we will have to generate to generate our investment return on the project. That's one of the effects that property tax has on us, but that's not the biggest effect. For us, the biggest effect is really how it lands on our tenant, because the way commercial property leases work is that the lease is a pure pass-through of all expenses to the tenant. So we as the landlord, even if we're a REIT headquartered in Indianapolis, we will pay tax and property tax on vacant space that we own. However, every space that's leased, the tax gets passed through to those tenants who are the job creators and who occupy our buildings. And it's a real direct expense for them. And just to put that into some perspective, using Norman Point 2 as an example, the property taxes on Norman Point 2 are somewhere in the range of $6 to $7 per square foot. That represents maybe 25 to 35% in a typical commercial building of a tenant's gross rent. A rent is comprised of three different components. There's the rent that you typically think of that's paid to the landlord for the space. In addition to that, our tenants pay all the operating expenses of the building and all the real estate taxes. So that real estate tax component can be 25 to 35% of the rent that they pay, or $6 to $7 per square foot. So for every foot of space that those tenants occupy, it's $6 to $7. It's a real impact. And to give you an example of what that impact might mean for a tenant, one of our tenants in one of our industrial buildings in Mendota Heights is Tivoli 2. Tivoli 2 is a company that manufactures the Snoopies and the Joe Mauer statues that are outside of Target Field. They're a local company. They've been around for 28 years, privately owned, family owned from St. Paul. About a year and a half ago, they came into our office and told us that they needed some rent relief. to stay in business. They were working on some projects for Disney that were slowing down because of the economy. Some of the projects that they were working on here weren't happening because of the economy. And they came in and asked for some rent relief. And they put together a very nice presentation and showed how they had taken their business down to its very essence, its very basics, had managed their staff down to its the lowest level possible to remain in business. And they had two more places to go to manage their expenses, trying to take control of the expenses that they could, in fact, on their own control. One was their bank, and they negotiated a loan forbearance agreement with their bank. And the other was their landlord. And we gave them rent relief to help them stay in business and get them through this difficult time. And while they're making that presentation, they talked a little bit about just overall expenses within their business. And at the time, they were using a state program to allow some of their workers to go on part-time, et cetera, and try to manage their time and their capital as best they could. But one of the things they told us is that for every $30,000 to $35,000 of additional expense that they incur in their business, that costs them one employee. So any $35,000, they've got to lose one more employee. They have to either terminate an employee, maybe put an employee on part-time. And that's where they got their business, too. They're now I talked to Hart Johnson, who helps run Tivoli 2 yesterday. And they are looking at their cash flow every single day to make sure that they can make it through this. And that's not an easy position for them to be in. It takes away from their productivity and what they can produce. And they need the economy to pick up and need expenses to go down so they can start generating some profits and then grow. And just to give you a sense, Senator Michel, for where the market is today, using very general terms, the market and space within the market is generally described as direct vacancy versus sublease vacancy and shadow space. That comprises the universe of available space within the market. Direct is space that we have that's just vacant. A sublease space is space that a company might have leased, and they've leased too much. They've got more space on their hands than they need, and they try to take it out to the market and lease it themselves. Shadow space is space, again, where the company has leased too much space, but they've decided to keep it and not sublease it to anybody, and that will be the space that they will then grow into as they grow. Direct vacancy rates today in the market, just using very general numbers across office and industrial, are in the 19% range. And that doesn't include the sublease and the shadow space that's out there. So for us and for our industry to begin thinking about building buildings again, and when we build an office building like Norman Point or the shops at West End, we're employing hundreds of workers for probably 15 to 18, sometimes longer, months on a job. And for us to get going and get back into the building and development business is going to require that those vacancy rates get down to generally the 10% level and be trending downward. That means we need an awful lot of job growth before that space can be filled, because our industry is completely dependent on job growth. And if we get the job growth and allow those companies to expand into that space, we can get those vacancy rates down to a point and get the market down to a point where building again will make some sense. For us, it doesn't seem that that's right around the corner. And I would guess that we're probably 3 to 5 years out from any real development in the commercial real estate market at this time.
And Mr. Masha, if I can just, on that point, so we're at 19% today, or in your last survey. How does that compare to 5 years ago, 2 years ago? I'm trying to, without seeing a graph, I'm trying to get a trend line in my brain. Mr. Masha.
Vacancy rates about 3 years ago, let's say, 4 years ago, were in that 10 to 11% range. When we decided to build Norman Point 2, which we decided to do in April of 2006, the Class A, so for the Class A top office building, the market, the Class A vacancy rates in Bloomington in the Southwest submarket were 7.6% when we decided to build that building. It took us 18 months to get that building out of the ground and open and operating. It opened in October of 2008. That building, we leased 80,000 square feet of 320,000 feet to the Hartford right away, and then the rest of the building stayed vacant until just this past summer when we leased the remainder of the space to the GSA. The Southwest submarket in particular has been hit the hardest. It's the submarket where a lot of the financial services firms are located. There's been an awful lot of space that's come back on the market. There were three new buildings that were built in around the 2006-2007 timeframe. And it's going to take a long time before that submarket gets back on its feet and going again. And it's the strongest submarket in the Twin Cities.
And Mr. Masha, just to continue my interruption, have you ever seen vacancy rates higher than 19%? Or maybe Ms. Rocco?
Vacancy rates are as high as they've ever been.
Okay.
I think the most accurate way to say it. There are a number of ways you can slice and dice the numbers. We've had times when vacancy rates were in the 20 to 22% range, all things considered. When you add sublease space and shadow space in, we're effectively at probably a 25 to 26% vacancy rate, but it's a little difficult to get our arms around how much shadow space and sublease space is really in the market at any given time.
And Mr. Masha, thank you for helping me with this. Is that is your 19% figure metro area, Twin Cities, statewide? Twin Cities, okay. Thank you.
Welcome. Thank you.
Do we want to move on to Mr. Wise then?
Very good.
Oh, hang on a second. Senator Kielash for Mr. Masha?
Yeah, Mr. Masha.
Senator Kielash.
One of the things that your vacancy rate doesn't account for is the fact that the commercial property was being overbuilt with the low interest rates, et cetera, at that time. So, you know, how much did the available commercial and industrial market or space became available in the last few years in order for, you know, this isn't just a fall off of business. It's also an increase in the amount of space, I think. So could you add something to that? Or?
Sure. That's an excellent question. Mr. Chair, Senator Kielash, if we look back to 1998 and the last commercial real estate depression, so to speak, that was brought on by overbuilding, clearly, mm-hmm. In the market. I would respectfully disagree that that's what happened in this case. There were three new speculative office buildings built in the Southwest around 2006 and 2007. Mm-hmm. With a vacancy rate of 7.6% in the Class A market at that time, it was the time to build. And as the person who had to make the decision to build Norman Point 2, over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, I've gone over that over and over many times in my head. Why? Everything seemed right. The market was right. The fundamentals within the market were right to do it. And Ryan building 2 Market Point and United Properties building 8200 Normandale were looking at it the same way. Those were really the only three large-scale speculative office projects that were built leading into this last market. The biggest problem that's happened is that spaces like, you know, what happened is that the new growth that everybody anticipated just fell off the cliff. So the demand wasn't going to be there. And what we've seen is tenants that have moved out of one space into another. So there's been a lot of lateral moving, but not a lot of real growth. So the available capital, what it did is instead of really support new construction and new development, it really went to support arguably overpaying for existing assets. So companies that came in and bought buildings as opposed to developing buildings went in and paid an amount that seemed like the right price at the time, but now with values falling as far as they have really slipped. And that was driven by the available capital. The problem that we had in this last development cycle is that the cost of development and even where the rents were didn't match up. It was tough even in 2006 when the market was right to build a building. It was very difficult to underwrite those costs and expenses to get to a point where we could say we're going to make the amount of money on this investment that we really should make for the risk that we're taking. So that the cost of construction at the time, the fact that rents hadn't grown substantially in the years prior to that, in part because of the dot-com bubble in 2001, led to a fairly difficult development atmosphere leading up to this. So in my mind, the market was not overbuilt, is not overbuilt, and we didn't commit in this crisis the same sins we committed in the last one.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Mr. Masha, the question I have relates specifically to firms that may have gone out of business and the vacancy rates. For example, I'm in the concrete block business, and I know that there's 5 concrete block plants you know, that have gone out of business in the 7-county metro area here that will never make concrete block again. And do you have a sense for how many real estate firms have gone out of business? And in that 19% vacancy rate, does that include properties that are in foreclosure as well, or is that a separate category?
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, the vacancy rate would include any property within the universe. So that would include properties that are currently under foreclosure. I do not have a sense for how many businesses have gone out of business in the commercial real estate industry. I think there are some very prominent members of our industry whose troubles over the last few years have been well documented. There are other many smaller players who are no longer in the business anymore. I don't know the number. It was something that, and again, whether it's development, which is a fairly difficult thing to do, but there are a lot of people, a lot of companies that with the availability of capital over the last number of years believed that commercial real estate was a good industry to get into. And with what's happened with the capital markets, I think some of the bets that they made have not panned out the way they expected. So my guess is that there are a number of companies who have done it, that they are not highly publicized, and I don't know the exact number.
Okay.
Senator Peterson.
Chair, follow up. The last question I have is, do you have a sense for how much you've had to reduce rents? I'm not asking you to give up any corporate secrets or confidential information, but does your industry have a sense or an idea of approximately how much rents have had to be reduced in order to keep the tenants that you have in buildings solvent themselves? Or
Mr. Chair, Senator Peterson, yes. We, when we, using Norman Point 2 again as an example, when we underwrote that building on our pro forma, we were expecting to receive net rents that were north of $18 per square foot. And when we looked at the market, we saw the Normandale project during the last good market in commercial real estate charging $19, maybe $20 per square foot in some cases, and figured that our building as a new building would be within that range. We did not want to underwrite the building at a rent that was north of where the market had ever been before in its history. Currently, we are seeing office deals get done, whether in our buildings and other buildings, in the $13 to $14 per square foot net rent range.
So greater than,
Senator
Mr.
Peterson.
Chair, so that's more than 30%
drop.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Nelson, briefly, and then I want to make sure we give Mr. Wise some time to present to the committee.
Yes, I will be brief. I'm just concerned about these vacancy rates even in a broader sense, and I'm just wondering, because of your expertise, maybe you might be able to comment on that. As we have these high vacancy rates, keeping the price of the commercial real estate depressed, and then how that's going to relate to the loan-to-asset values and refinancing. We have a number of these buildings that were built during this time that are now going to be needing to refinance, and yet looking at the loan-to-value ratios, I'm just wondering what your projections are, knowing that I think the banking regs are a lot tighter, and even performing loans may actually be called because the loan-to-value is just not there. And do you have any projections or thoughts on that?
Mr. Masha.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, my projections would be fairly pessimistic. It's a very difficult problem that requires cooperation on many different sides, and especially on the lender side. And I think and we're a little bit unique in the sense that we don't typically finance each project separately with a lender. As a public company, we are able to access the public capital markets and other capital sources, which allow us to essentially do our developments on our own. But talking to people within the market, it's kind of a hit-and-miss thing. There are some lenders, I think, that are more willing to work with building owners than others. Some lenders do not want these properties back and take the trouble onto their hands, and are more willing to do workout arrangements with their borrowers than perhaps other lenders. So it's a little bit hit-and-miss. My sense, and this is purely a guess, is that as these things typically go, The outlook will be extremely pessimistic. There will be some people saying it's not going to be nearly as bad as we thought, and the answer will be somewhere in the middle.
Thank you, Mr. Masha. And Mr. Wise, welcome to the committee. I want to make sure we give you a chance to give some remarks. And I think you wear a slightly different hat from Mr. Masha. You're a business owner.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Mr. Wise, if you could just introduce yourself. And
I will. My name is Steve Wise. I am CFO and one of the owners of Cast Screw Machine Products. We are a manufacturer up in Brooklyn Center on the corner of Highway 100 and France Avenue North. You've driven past my billboard 1,000 times and probably never paid attention to it. I am also past chair of the board of the Twin West Chamber of Commerce. Grew up in St. Louis Park, went to Benilde, St. Marcus. My roots run pretty deep into this wonderful state. Pat said that his business was not rocket science compared to my business. It's way rocket science. I make parts, ladies and gentlemen. Parts like this, little nuts and bolts for people like Polaris, little pulley hubs for people like Toro. Articat, Bobcat, those four customers comprise about 80% of my business. As their business goes, that's how my business goes. We have been in business since 1945 on that corner in Brooklyn Center since 1965. I own four or five buildings up there, depending on how the property tax people count the buildings, about $4.5 million worth of property. That $4.5 million is kind of hard to get a hold of because if I'm not making parts in those buildings, they are worth nothing. Talk to the guy next to me who just went out of business, and his building has been sitting vacant for 3 years. He has not had one walkthrough in that building. The buildings, when people go down in those buildings, they stay empty for a long, long time. Early 2008, I had 125 employees. The bottom fell out of everything. I went down to about 70 employees. We're now up to about 90. Cast Screw is busy. We're feeling good about the future, so we're feeling pretty bullish. I used to think that I understood how property taxes worked. I'm not too sure of that anymore. Like I said, I've got about $4.5 million in buildings and property up there. In 2010, my assessed value dropped by about $178,000. That sounds good. But my property taxes went up by $9,500. Now, let me tell you about those fixed costs and what they mean to a business like mine. When I held up this little part here, I sell this for 46 cents. I make about 3 cents on it. Okay? I got to sell a lot of these parts to make up that tax increase. This little guy, $2.52, mostly comprised of material. But I make a lot of money on this one. I make about 14 cents on this feller. Again, I got to make a lot of parts to make up the tax increases that I see in my property taxes. What we're here to purport today is the Senate bill that may cut my property taxes. Now, when I took a look at my tax bills and what that means to Cast Screw Machine Products, $176,000 I pay up there per year in taxes, on property taxes. About 24% of that on average is the state component of that. That's about $42,000 in taxes. Now, we've all heard about the Tax Freedom Day that goes around every once in a while. 99 days we have to work through the work year to make up our federal, state, local taxes as individual citizens of the United States of America. If I figure out this is a tax day in Cast Screw Machine Products, working with my 6% profit that I make on these parts, that adds 15 tax days that I either have to continue to work or that I can save if this proposal goes through. Now, what would I do with those savings? Now, a lot of the folks around here, they say, you're only making 6% on your money. You probably would like to take my $4.5 million that I've got up there and have me give that to you, that I could make more than 6%. We don't feel like we're in business. No, this sounds kind of lame. We're not in business to make money. We're in business to take care of 90 families up there in Brooklyn Center. We provide good jobs, good wages, health insurance, and retirement benefits. That's what we're in business for, ladies and gentlemen. And that's what we would like to have, a little tax relief that we can continue to provide those things for our employees. I guess that's really all I've got to say. I know we're running out of time, but if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
And Mr. Wise, I'm sure there will be some questions. And first of all, on behalf of the committee, let me say thank you. Thank you for owning a business and running a business here in Minnesota. And I'm glad to hear that you see some signs of optimism. I guess I wanted to get into that a little bit with you. You said, I think you said the word bullish. So, maybe we should just adjourn the legislature and not make any more changes and let you get going. But can you get a little more into what you're projecting for 2010? Why are you bullish?
Well, when I mentioned those four large customers, what we used to look at back in the last 2 years, we looked at about a 6-week lead time. Now we're filling out to about 3 months. They are all increasing their build schedules. Everybody looks pretty happy about what's going on. My competition, on the other hand, as these people get busier and where they're going to buy their parts from, no surprise, China and India. I've never admitted this in a forum this large, and I'm embarrassed about it. But the most largest profit margin that I make in my shop comes from a part that I broker out to Taiwan. These parts go to Toro. Four of them go into every Toro walk behind mower that you purchase out there. I couldn't compete with them anymore. They said, you better broker these out. Toro said this to me. You better broker these out or you're going to lose it. Of course, I broker it out. I make a ton of money on these parts. I never touch these parts. They come over from Taiwan in a container. I take them over into over to El Paso, Texas. Toro comes across from Mexico, picks them up and takes them. I never even see these parts, but I make the most money on these parts. Now, our broker came in from Taiwan the other day, and I was talking to him, and I kind of, well, how are things going in Taiwan and with our parts? And he said, well, I got a little secret for you. We're going to Vietnam because they're cheaper. So this is what I'm up against, you guys. I have incredible cost pressures coming from all of my OEMs. I can only do so much in efficiencies. We're a pretty efficient shop. We work really hard. These fixed costs that continue to creep up and nip me in the behind, these are what's going to kill me. And I ask for any help that you guys can extend me.
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, this question, anyone on the panel can ask this question. I think you alluded to it a little bit here as we move into, obviously we're in a global economy. But can you just speak a little bit to how the Internet has impacted brick-and-mortar spaces, especially with regards as it relates to property taxes and it relates to sales taxes?
None of my parts are taxable, so I've got nothing to say about sales tax.
Okay.
Anyone else?
Well, I guess...
Senator Howe.
Mr. Chair, I guess the question is with regards to real estate and property taxes, is there a shift more with the Internet sales that they don't need to have the brick-and-mortar facade? And how does that affect? Have we seen this trend? Is it going to continue?
Mr. Chair, Senator Howe, it's very difficult to tell. I think that was something that in the industry we were very nervous about coming into 2000, 2001, and what impact that might have on retail space, for instance. And people shopping online, whether they'd continue to go to malls and to go to stores. On the office side of the business, we were worried about the impact on space and whether more people would be working from home as opposed to coming into the traditional office. I think what we found over the years is that it wasn't the impact wasn't nearly as bad as we thought it could be. At the same time, I think what we're seeing as a trend is that companies need a little less space. They're finding more to do with less. They're putting people in smaller spaces. They're doing a little bit more community working, so to speak, and allowing people more arrangements to work from home, so they're able to trim down their space needs a bit. So it's had an impact, but it's difficult to say that it's had a real big impact on our industry to date.
Mr. Wise, I'm trying to think how to formulate this question. I guess the bottom line of this committee, and hopefully this legislature, is, you know, what can we do to make things such that you can do more and can hire more in your property in Brooklyn Center? I don't pretend for a moment that you have a 10-point plan in front of you, but is it taxes? Is it regulation? What can we do to increase your confidence level, the confidence level of your customers? That's the discussion we're trying to have. And again, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but anything that you can share now or in follow up with the committee would be really, really valuable.
Well, Mr. Chair, the taxes that we're here to talk about today, the property taxes are my number one fixed cost. Everything else pretty variable. My health care costs, my labor costs, everything else, as I sell more parts, I can cover those because they're all variable. The problem is that I can't go out and someone says, well, if you need to make more money, go out and sell more parts. I've got to have the customers. I can't. These are not Home Depot parts. These are customized parts. I don't even have a product of my own. These are all other people's parts that I make for their assembly lines. Minnesota is in a great place logistically to be able to supply the rest of the country. I think that Minnesota has a great educational base that people look towards, that I think we have a good legacy for. But I know this cost creep is what's really hard, because when it really boils down to it, all of my OEMs, all they care about is cost. The only thing that's keeping me in business is my delivery. I would invite any of you, if you want to come out and tour my facility. I have got shelves and shelves. I have got 3,000 active jobs in my shop at any given time. That means that I have got parts sitting on the shelves. For those OEMs that want to change their production lines, they've got to have those parts right now. They do not want them bobbing around in the middle of the Pacific wondering when they're going to hit their assembly lines. So that's what I've got going for me, is good logistics. But I could not do that if I did not have good working capital. Working capital comes from controlling costs. So anything that this committee or anybody out there can do to help me control costs is helpful. Regulatory is not a big deal for me. I think we do things all right for nuts and bolts manufacturers like me.
Thank you. I have Mr. Peterson. Senator Peterson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wise, I'm in manufacturing myself, and I'm always curious to know, what would be your, or where is your toughest competitor located? I'm always kind of curious to know, you know, people that you compete with most, are they in Wisconsin, Florida, you know, Iowa? Where's your toughest competitor located?
My direction wise, I'm sorry. My direct competitors come from usually around here. I've got one. There aren't a lot of people that do what I do. I've got one in Alexandria and one up in Maple Grove that kind of are in my niche. And but most of my OEMs, they like to stick with very few vendors. And we are the number one manufacturer for all four of those big groups that I mentioned before. But when it comes to large volume parts, now, a part like this, I make about 200,000 of these a year. Parts like these, about 100,000 a year. When we start talking millions of nuts and bolts, they're going overseas, without a doubt.
Thank you.
Mr. Masha, did you want to take a shot at a piece of that? And then I have Senator Lilly with a question.
Mr. Chair, I was actually going to go back a little bit on one of the answers that I previously gave about the current state of the market. And I think I gave a sense for where we see things today. But I will say that, you know, in following up on Mr. Wise's comment about being bullish, there seems to be an uptick going forward. When we look at market information and vacancy rates, et cetera, we're typically taking every 6 months look at a snapshot. I do expect that as the year-end numbers for 2010 come up, that there will be some very modest improvement in those rates going forward. We had a good December this year on the office leasing side and got a couple of deals done. But at the same time, and we're seeing more activity, both the industrial and the office side, going forward. So that is some reason for optimism. But at the same time, we had to MoneyGram is moving its headquarters to Texas. Nestle is moving out of its plant in St. Louis Park to Eau Claire. So it feels like things are getting better and things are starting to improve. But every day there's maybe two steps forward and one step back sort of thing. So it feels a little bit like we're on the cusp. And that we really can't afford to have anything that would take away any momentum that we're just starting to develop within the market.
And I'll finish up with Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair and panel, one of the conversations that we've had, and Mr. Masha, you started to address this, but one of the conversations we have had in this committee is discussing clarity, vision, visibility going forward, and how that impacts your decision-making process. NAIOP, Ms. Rico, does a fantastic job of informing its members about the current status of the market, where it stands, where the vacancies are, where they are in different areas of the Twin Cities. But could you please share with us how, once you see stability in the market, once you have some clarity and vision going forward, how long does it take us to, and what are the key indicators that we will watch to see the market start returning and start improving so we can start building jobs, start building buildings again, start filling these spaces?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lilly, the For us, the key indicators on the office side are job growth and then watching those vacancy rates. But at the same time, we have to look at what our expected rents are within the market and see some rent growth. Construction costs, in spite of the economy or maybe because of it, have not come down substantially. So the cost of building a project today isn't much different than it was 5 or 6 years ago, but rents have dropped off substantially. So there needs to be that growth to take some of that vacancy rate out and then the corresponding increase in rents in order to justify spending the amount of money that we spend when we build a building. On the industrial side, the industrial business is a little less dependent on job growth and more dependent on consumer spending. And many of the warehouses in town are there to hold products that are sold by retailers, et cetera. And as consumer spending picks up, and you know the industrial tenants we have in our portfolio nationally, retailers' inventories dropped substantially over the last few years. So warehouse space wasn't needed. We're starting to see those inventories tick up and the need for some of that industrial and warehouse space to come back on that segment of the market, and that's something that we're watching very carefully going forward. There's also the manufacturing component, and some of our spaces house manufacturers. And again, I think as spending picks up, as the economy picks up, manufacturing picks up, that will lead to better times for us in the days ahead.
Members, I'm told there's another meeting in this very room, so we've hit our allotted time, but I want to especially thank Mr. Wise. We wish you great success and more success in the coming year, and thank you, Mr. Masha and Ms. Rocco, for your contributions this morning. The committee stands adjourned.
Thank you.
See you, Chairman. Pretty good panel.